Today I talk with Huda Fakhreddin, writer, translator, and scholar of Arabic literature. Among the many topics we touch upon are the challenges of teaching Arabic literature, especially Palestinian literature, in a time of genocide, when universities, professional organizations, and political groups militate against any honest discussion of these topics and punish those who do. We talk about the notion of belonging and the importance of being able to choose what to belong to and what not to. Huda speaks of the freedom found in living in Arabic and explains what that means to her. She also reads in Arabic and English Nama Hassan's stunning and wrenchingly beautiful poem, Old Song. Speaking Out of Place is produced in collaboration with The Creative Process and is made with support from Stanford University. I alone am responsible for its content. We hope you enjoy this and other episodes. Please help support Speaking Out of Place by subscribing via our website, speakingoutofplace.com, following us on Instagram, and following me on Blue Sky. You can give me your feedback, suggest people to invite, and topics to cover. Also, please check out my book of the same title, published by Haymarket Books. Kianga Yamata Taylor calls it, quote, the exact book we need for the troubled historical moment through which we are living. To begin with, thank you so much for being on the show again. It's wonderful to see you even under these circumstances. I want to begin by asking you a really open-ended question, which stems from a line from the materials you sent me. And the line is, nothing should ever be the same after this. Could you speak about how this applies to your life? I mean, your personal life, familia, professional, and more. And take as much time as you want to elaborate upon this in whichever way you want, because I think this is really at the heart of a lot of what you sent me.
Yeah, this is a huge question, Dave. Nothing should ever be the same because nothing has been the same. And I don't know where the starting point is. It seems at this point ridiculous to say fall of 2023. In my experience, at least, the state of emergency that I found myself experiencing began before that. And as we here in Philadelphia at the University of Pennsylvania had to go through a prelude to genocide, which was the big controversy around the Palestine Rights Literature Festival. But even that might not be a starting point. As I'm Lebanese, I grew up in Lebanon during the Civil War, and I came to the United States as a graduate student with the intention of going back. Never wanted to stay here. I really thought that my life would happen in Beirut, in a city that I loved and hated in the healthiest of ways. My investments, literary and intellectual, were rooted there. So I came here as a graduate student and joined a PhD program. And then events continued to unfold there, making life more and more of a risk, building a life in a place like Lebanon. But the most important counterpoint in my life was meeting my partner, Ahmed, who's Palestinian. So immediately, my life became the life of a Palestinian by association. So now, after 691 days of genocide, when I try to look back and think, when did things stop being the same? I don't know where to start dating that. Of course, the past 2 years, almost 2 years, have been surreal. I sometimes don't believe that we're going through what we're going through, because as security concerns have become something we think about at home, when we walk from home to campus, in my office, I'm constantly anxious to open my mail because often there are things that will require a lot of energy and time and emotion and are emotionally taxing. And rage, there's a lot of rage now in many aspects of my life. But all that aside, again, my personal experience, both professional and personal and at home, familial, are not exceptional. Many other people are experiencing intimidation and silencing and feel cornered and censored and silenced and oppressed just because they took a stand, a very decent, normal, basic human stand against genocide. When I say in the material, and I think you're referring to some of the articles and maybe intros to translations, nothing should be the same. But of course, on the cosmic level, nothing should be the same when this planet silently witnesses a genocide continue to happen for almost 2 years. Nothing should be the same. Something has been broken that will never be mended again in who we are as a species and who we are as individuals and as collectives. But I've made that statement several times talking about the work we do here as academics and as teachers and instructors, and in my case, as a student of the Arabic literary tradition. Every time I sit down to write something or prepare for a class or even speak with a student, I cannot do it without the knowledge, the awareness that here we are engaged with a tradition as it is being annihilated. Here we are translating and reading literature that belongs to a tradition that is under attack in the most vicious, vile, savage way. And we are aware of it. Had we not been aware, there would have been some consolation, but everybody knows, everybody has seen the images, everybody continues to see them day in, day on all sizes of screens and all forms of communication. So how can you put that aside and then pretend that you are an expert in a genre or a historical period? How can you put that outside and walk into a classroom and pretend to do things as you've always done them before? It's impossible. I think it's hypocritical, and many other descriptions that are more disturbing than that. Some friends and close people in my life think that this insistence on centering Gaza all the time in everything I do might be dangerous, and it has been. But I think it's the least we can do is to start to launch from Gaza in everything we do, everything we think about. It's not just about literature and translation and poetry and the media, but it's also the climate, the planet, raising children, relationship with parents, travel, food, drink. How can you not think of Gaza in every single attempt at continuing to stay alive? Yeah, I don't know if that's a response to your
It's a great beginning, because I know that you could elaborate on any of those points, and we will in the podcast. And I was thinking that so many things I reacted to. Again, at the beginning of your comment, you said that you've been targeted. And then later on in your comment, you brought up what I thought was the most poignant and disturbing, which is for doing your job. You basically were hired to be a professor of Arabic literature. You were doing your job. And when the world turns into a space where that's a crime, and one of my friends calls it a truth crime, this is a problem. But even before that, you talked about the human species, and I'm no longer on Instagram, but at some point I was, and I posted, "This teaches us that the human species is a failed experiment." And Susan Al-Bahawa posted back, "I've been saying this for years." And this is why it really puts us back on our heels in so many different ways that you've articulated. And in particular, you mentioned the word hypocrisy, and it's so haunting for me to walk down the halls of our universities and smell the fear and anger of many of our colleagues, but also their indifference, and I'm not sure which is worse. And I'm thinking about the title of Omar Al-Khad's book, "One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This." And when I had him on the show, I asked him who he was writing to. And he said that initially it was to himself, that he felt he had not been out there forcefully enough, early enough, but he wanted to make amends in some ways. You, in fact, mentioned something akin to this in one of the pieces you sent me. In 10 years, we'll be doing land, 5 years, land acknowledgments, including the Palestinians. How do you deal with this? The fact that there'll be this recuperation of the institution and the good stature of the humanities.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Omar's book. That was a very powerful book to read, but it took me longer than I expected to read it. It was difficult. And I kept thinking, yes, this is Omar bringing himself to a reckoning. This is accounting, revising, critiquing himself where he was and where he is now. And I kept thinking, this book, as brilliant as it is, not for me. I'm not the intended audience. And I kept thinking, oh, I would love to gift this to so-and-so. I'm thinking so many people in my life who need to read Omar's book. As they find themselves slowly mustering some courage to be against this someday, especially those who are not, those who are afraid, those who are embarrassed. We have had a few actions on campus in the past few months before summer and even now since the semester has begun. And as all institutions and academics and students, especially now in the beginning of this new year, are rushing to obey in advance. Obeying in advance is the term we use in action group. Right? Because of all the new restrictions and the intimidation and the threats and the deportations and the arrests, and things have become very violent and dangerous in ways that they weren't maybe early on. And in these actions, now people are distorting their feelings and their commitments in order to protect themselves and others. So to give you an example, even when abiding by all the new ridiculous guidelines on campuses, and even if you're doing something as benign as just standing there, making a statement of mourning, especially in the aftermath of such huge loss, thinking of journalists who were killed live on the air as we were watching them do their job, under the most horrific of circumstances, but then we see them in real time, assassinated, murdered in the most brutal ways. So even in supposedly low-risk actions on campuses now, and just to put yourself there, your body in the space, to remind others that they are witnesses of genocide, whether they like it or not, the most devastating is not the heckling and the Zionist intimidation and the flags and the curses. Those are expected and predictable, and somehow you go there waiting for them to happen. What's most devastating are when people recognize what you're doing and then immediately look away, afraid or embarrassed to be drawn into this. They know what you're doing, but they won't let themselves sit with it, even for a minute as they rush past you. And it feels like, who are these people? Who are these students? What are they going to learn as they rush past a silent vigil for tens and hundreds of thousands of people, children, men, women? They're rushing to which class? What are they going to allow themselves to think after they did not allow themselves to stand there and just be in the relatively uncomfortable space? Yeah, I don't know how to deal with this. I think I am very disillusioned with a lot of action and thinking that we can continue to fight back using the same methods that we did very early on. We've protested, we've marched, we've gone on strike, we've exposed ourselves. But the fact is, genocide has happened. It continues to happen. And it's expanding. And this country is enabling it more and more every day. And it's become almost futile to keep doing what we've been doing. I don't know what it is, but it's definitely very humbling. All of us who found a moment of community and agency and thought of ourselves as revolutionaries for a moment and got distracted by that. I hope that we've come down from that high, now acknowledge that we haven't accomplished anything, because all the gains, the action groups, the classes that are being taught, the many books that are being published, the many awards being won, those are all a distraction as genocide continues to happen.
I'm going to share with you something that a previous episode, I don't know if you've run into it or not, but maybe you've run into her book. Her name is Linda Kikievich, and she wrote a book called Palestine 1492, and it's called A Report Back. And she's an amazing person, first-gen immigrant student who is located in Los Angeles, of Guatemalan background. And long story short, she becomes involved in Palestine work, and at the same time becomes involved with the Zapatistas. So she's at Chiapas and she's meeting Palestinians there, and she's in Palestine and hearing about this resonance between the two movements. And her book basically ends with taking a page from the Zapatistas. Stop looking at the world as a negotiation between the below and the above, and move laterally. Talk, the below has to start talking with each other. And I'm completely skipping any meeting with any administrators. It's futile. I'm more and more convinced, and I should have been convinced a bit earlier on, American universities are neoliberal Zionist institutions. That is what they are. And we have spent so much energy taking them at their word. It took a long time for us to finally realize that their word means nothing. And this whole thing about academic freedom and freedom of speech, of course, doesn't apply to Palestine. So I think in the last year and going into this one, to pick up your point, we at Stanford are really rebuilding our base and talking with each other and being patient with each other and realizing that, of course, it's not enough, but the mood in the country has changed. I mean, it has. And it's not because of us, it's because of the Palestinians persisting and daring to be alive. But I think things are changing. So as much as people avert their eyes and whatnot, but maybe in the silence of their own dorm rooms, they're behaving differently. It might be the public facing of this that is embarrassing to them. So we're going to dorms. We're going into spaces where students are, into the libraries, just talking. And this is not enough, but it gives you the sense that it's something and that the consequences may not be insignificant. And this sort of leads me to the question I was going to ask, which is about teaching. And you talk about how students are leading us in so many ways. And I've started to give a course. Again, I'm trying to acknowledge the repression on campus. We have titles of certain things. So I've come up with a rather innocuously entitled course. It's called Belonging in Literature. Who would be against belonging? And so we start with bell hooks, do a lot of Black feminist writing, also Palestinian, Asian American, indigenous text, to both acknowledge the importance of belonging, but also to critique its various forms. And we spend some time asking the question, what happens when you're forced to belong to something you don't want to belong to? And the students welcome that discussion because they want to belong, but they don't want to be forced into the compartments. And you talk about this in some of the pieces that you write that have been prefabricated for us to exist in. If we want to exist, we have to exist there. And Fadi's thing about Palestine and Arabic, what are the spaces where Palestinians and their supporters can be in that's not complicit in some ways? And I found that the students are the most refreshing part about being on campus, really, because they're disabused of, they haven't been mauled to death as we who go through graduate school become. Could you talk about some of your experiences in the classroom? I'd really be fat because you're such a great speaker. I haven't had the privilege of being your student, but I've heard you lecture and you connect so well with people. What's going on in the classroom? Because that's one of the spaces that I think is still relative. It's not completely immune, but relatively okay.
Yeah. So before that, a few comments on what you said, the speaking horizontally to each other and not worrying anymore about presenting or addressing ourselves to authority, whether in an institution or beyond, I think is crucial. This is one of the biggest lessons we've learned. We've also learned, those of us who went to graduate school, have went and have been through the industry of academia and tenure and review and think so little of ourselves, or have been conditioned to think so little of ourselves until somebody from above acknowledges us or gives us a pat on the shoulder. Students taught us how to get out of that, especially students who had to hold down encampments, who had to stand and resist the institution physically with their bodies when the dogs and the police were unleashed on them. They taught us that don't fall for the trap of when the provost or the dean invites you to their office. It's not a gesture of goodwill. It's a trap because you know what the outcome is going to be. And yes, you have been conditioned as a creature of this institution and the system to rejoice when you get that kind of attention, whether you admit it to yourself or not, because you've been assessed and reassessed and measured up by it. So when they pretend to show goodwill, you rush to receive it. The students have been disillusioned over and over by it and taught us that, remember, as difficult as it is, that you should turn your back, like a Hamdallah does, the Palestinian character. Turn your back. You shouldn't be concerned with proving or disproving or catering or even addressing your university's president or provost or deans. They are lost causes and big distraction anyway.
Let me just exert one point because it's, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we did a Palestine graduation ceremony last year, year before last. And when the student said, I think I know less after 4 years at Stanford than I did coming in. And I said, if you think that's bad, think about going to graduate school and getting your PhD and then getting tenure. It's a wonder that we can put one foot in front of the other. I wanted to share that.
It is a wonder. And that brings me back to the idea of belonging, forced belonging, and compartmentalization. This is a system that thrives on putting us in corners and in niches and in departments and programs. And those boundaries are very dangerous, especially for us in the humanities. For me to be trained to think of myself as an area studies scholar is disgraceful. And if I accept it, then it's on me. And even worse, a Middle Eastern scholar. What the heck is a Middle Easterner anyway? Yeah. And somebody who studies the Middle Easterner. And those are imaginary, violent categories that those of us who have been through the factory have been programmed to accept and navigate our lives within. Gaza has taught us to liberate ourselves from this system and from the corners it assigns us to. And this brings me to the class. I keep reminding myself that I wrote a PhD dissertation on Abbasid poetry and the modernist movement in the 20th century. This was post 2011. It feels like ancient history now. But even that dissertation, that project, received a little bit of pushback. Somebody told me, oh, but that's too broad. What are you an expert in? Is it pre-modern or modern? Are you an Abbasid scholar or a scholar of the Arabic poetic modernist movement? And I had to argue against that at the dissertation level. I also had to write a response to that when my first book was being considered for publication, because the publisher wasn't used to thinking of a book that addresses the entirety of the Arabic poetic tradition. How do we sell this? Who's the audience? The assumption is a person who is interested in reading about Abbasid poetry is not going to be interested in modern poetry at all. It does not concern them, vice versa, which is an atrocity, I think. And these restrictions are more easily applied to other traditions than they are to hegemonic ones like English and French. To say, I'm interested in all of Anglophone poetry, easier to do than to say, I'm interested in the entirety of the Arabic poetic tradition from pre-Islamic times, the earliest example, to what's being written in Gaza today. Mm. Those are all my concern and my field. So belonging is oppressive within the institution and the system and the university because it's imaginary and it's imposed. And students somehow fall into it when they choose their classes, when they choose their majors and their minors or their departments. And this is why I found in my experience challenging that from day one inside a classroom is very productive.
Yeah.
And, you know, to tell them, this is what I'm interested in. I also read English poetry. I wrote an MA thesis on Hamlet. This is my concern. My concern is language. And I don't think one language is better than the other. And I think if you have a love of language or poetry in one language, then you should naturally be concerned and invested in poetry in other languages as well. But also how to bring that into how they think of themselves, the identity politics that an institution also plays on and abuses. Who are you and what should concern you and what shouldn't? Groups of students who end up signing up for a class related to Arabic literature are already curious, whether for better or for worse. They're curious about what kind of relationship they can form with this tradition. They could have personal ties, heritage students, families, but they could also come into the class in an antagonistic way or a condescending way. And we've often, in a class, have learned so much from each other, especially when the conversation doesn't start on a good note, especially when we all come into the class with our guards up. And in the past 2 years, I've had experiences like that in the class where immediately the student is there because they are working through something. Yeah. They want to prove something to themselves or confirm it. And they're going to hold on to whatever that is until something breaks. I still find, despite the hostile environment on campuses, still find the classroom to be the most liberated. I've had to teach under very unusual circumstances where students are not told where the class is beforehand for security reasons. It feels like we're doing something undercover. It definitely changes the tone. The students self-censor necessarily when they find themselves waiting for a message to arrive about which room we're going to meet in, don't tell anyone else, or they walk down the hall and keep looking over their shoulder. It's been unusual and it's sad because it really just ruins part of this, the ability to think and speak and share freely because we know we're in a hostile environment. But still, the classroom has been one of the most rewarding and safest place in the past 2 years. And again, speaking about belonging, I've mostly only taught classes related to Palestine, but it's not an unnecessary or an exaggerated focus because I teach Arabic poetry and Palestine, when it comes to speaking about modern Arabic literature in general, is key, is central. It's not something that I'm imposing because of the circumstances, and there's nothing wrong with doing that, but it comes naturally to use Palestine and the Palestinian experience and Palestinian contributions to Arabic culture and literature and journalism and the media and the arts as a lens to introduce the entirety of modern Arabic poetry or literature. It's very useful, it's logical, it's doesn't need to be justified. The other class that I will probably teach in the spring again, and speaking of what we name things and now how conscious we are now about the surveillance and the consequences and the scrutiny of our classes and their titles, the class is called Resistance Literature from Pre-Islamic Arabia to Palestine. And this is the class that was mentioned in the congressional hearing, which led to the stepping down of our former president. And it's ridiculous and so dumb that the congressmen who were waiving the syllabus thought that it was enough to say, oh, look, this class is called Resistance Literature from Pre-Islamic Arabia to Palestine. That's enough condemnation of it, which is ridiculous. So I, maybe out of spite or rage or injury, whatever it is, I'm insisting on this title. So I've taught it twice since then, and we'll teach it again in the spring. And I don't know if I will hear from someone higher up about this title, but I will deal with it when we get to it. But I think that the expansiveness of the title, the fact that the class announces its purview as this, the entirety of time in the Arabic poetic tradition, is something that I'm insisting on. And we start with Gaza and we read backwards to see that in the moment of genocide, it's our responsibility, if we are engaging with our history or our tradition, to read it through Gaza, because how else would you read it? Whether you're reading a poem about abandon and about grief that is 1,400 years old, what better way to read it than through the lens of Gaza? You are reactivating whatever real, immediate, urgent aspects of that poem were. And if poetry lives and doesn't die, then it should be able to perform this task for us, to speak of Gaza from across centuries.
Wow, so many things to say in response. But to begin with, I'm sure I'm not erring in saying this, but your students must be so grateful that you're there. I know so much labor and so much grief, but the fact that you were there teaching these courses is, in an odd way, a vindication of the whole enterprise of education. If we're going to say certain things are forbidden, then that's not education, that's just propaganda. And you're giving them a sense that these things can happen, even at the cost. And you're modeling something really important for them that they'll take into their lives in all sorts of different ways.
I hope so.
And then in terms of the title, if you think about resistance, I'm of the generation where there was the French resistance. There was, you think of the Warsaw Ghetto. This is what's so proprietary about what's right or what's not acceptable, and the way the Zionists have commandeered the discourse. And I'm gearing myself. I've been asked to give a talk on genocide on Saturday for a group called Democrats for Palestine. So it's a small group, but it's interesting. And I've gone a few times, and there are always these hecklers that show up. And so I'm going to say, I want to acknowledge at the beginning that the term genocide is a modern invention that's specifically geared to the Holocaust, and certain things come out of it that are really important. For example, the idea of non-refoulement. You cannot turn away somebody seeking asylum. That comes from the horrific fact of Jews being turned back. Or think about the responsibility to protect. That comes out of the Nuremberg trials. So what I'm trying to do is set the stage. None of that is untrue. It's absolutely true. But this is what is so perverse about what Israel's doing to the Palestinians. It is distorting all of that. It's throwing it out the window and saying, no, there's one kind of resistance accessible and one kind that's not. And we are going to decide which one it is. And so, yeah.
Definitely, the distortion of language is, we see it everywhere. Certain words have become criminal. Certain, resistance is one of them, but not the most prominent, but the other words, the Arabic words that have uses in different areas, like intifada, for example, or phrases like from the river to the sea, just to criminalize them and to push people to fear saying them and hearing them is unbelievable. But also what the Zionist project has continuously done from its beginning is to distort Jewish history, Jewish pain, and to exploit it. And I think a lot about, just because by default or by the fact of my job as an instructor, where I interface with many students, and many of my students are Jewish here at Penn, young people who are 7, 18, 19, 20, who are doing tremendous work to rethink who they thought they were and to save themselves from designist brainwashing that they've been raised up in. I can see the difficult work that happens in the classroom and outside it. And it's often very rewarding to witness it and to be alongside it as they do it. So I'm not doing any of it. They come to the class. They get all the credit for that. And one of the connections going back to belonging in this class on resistance literature, the Jew is the Arab. The Arab is originally the Jew. And the Arabic poetic tradition is full of Jewish voices that are quintessentially Arab and Arabic as well. And it's good to remember them and bring them into a classroom, into a conversation in a moment like this, because as the conflation is one of the biggest things between Judaism and Jewishness, and Zionism is one that we continue to resist and challenge and fight against. And sometimes the easiest way to do that is just to go back to Jewish traditions and heritage, poetry and music, and place it in its right context, which often is Arabic. Zionists' attack on Jewish languages in itself is a lesson to remember and go back to in classes in the humanities at this point. And again, young people, Jewish, Muslim, Christian, atheists, of all kinds, are doing such tremendous, great, difficult work. All we need to do is follow their lead and give them room and space, safe
exactly.
space to do the thinking that's being criminalized by the institutions and to learn so much.
Exactly, because these students are saying, this doesn't make sense. I mean, just on the face of it, what we've been taught doesn't explain the world to us anymore. It cannot. So we have to come up with other possibilities. And this is why I love teaching. I learned so much from my students, and I'm also encouraged by the fact that they haven't been entirely brainwashed. I'd like to get to poetry, because the poem that you recently sent me by Nima Hassan, Old Song, is absolutely wrenching and beautiful and compelling, and I was stunned by it. I was wondering if you could do us the favor, I mean, portions or the entirety, for us in Arabic and then in English, whichever sections you want to comment on, because it's absolutely stunning.
I've never read this poem out loud before. And as you see from my note, of course, I mentioned Fadi Jouda in my note because he sent it to me. And something about belonging. Genocide has created communities among those who are grieving, and that's something I am grateful for. I was in Beirut as in the summer, and when you're in Beirut now, there are so many things, horrific things, about to happen or happening in Gaza, in Syria, and then the Lebanese situation, which is beyond description in how ridiculous it is and how much of a distraction it is. So one day I received this text with this poem, and I had heard of Naima Hassan, and I do follow her on Facebook, and she's a poet. She's a mother of seven, I think. She's a social worker surviving genocide in Gaza. And I was just astounded by her ability to write. I feel like I can't sit down and focus and put three sentences together. And here was this person who was living a genocide, surviving it hour by hour, and posting. Of course, she has opinions and sometimes emotions that she shares. She shares continuously. And again, that's a form of resistance. But this poem struck me by the fact that it was able to also speak about love in a time like this. And I will read the translation, or maybe start with the Arabic. Ughniyatun qadima, old song, and this is the title we decided to give it because Naima didn't have a title for it. And when I went back and asked her, she said, I would have called it uhibbuka, yani I love you. And if you notice the word I love you, the phrase I love you in Arabic is one word. It's just because the verb can also carry within it all the other pronouns. So that's what she means when she talks about short and small phrases. So I'll read the Arabic, part of the Arabic first. أحبك العبارات الطويلة تحتاج جدرانا ومخيما وصبية لها جديلة من قمح تحمل ملعقة سكر بين أناملها مثل غيمة ملونة أو موسما ينمو فيه قصب السكر. ستكتبها إذن على قطعة قماش كبيرة ليكتفي بها رواد المساجد وعباد الرحمن وبائع الشراب المحلى ستصبح أذكارا للشارع المهدوم لبائع الدخان العربي وسارق الطحين سيتلوها من يملك رغيف خبز ورصاصة فارغة وحمارا بعربة مكسورة. I love you is enough. A longer phrase requires sprawling walls, refugee camps, and a girl with braids long as wheat fields, a candy swirl the color of a rainbow cloud between her fingers. A longer phrase requires a season when sugarcane grows. I love you is enough, so write it then, on a large piece of cloth to sustain the mosque-goers, those servants of the merciful and the peddler of sweetened drinks. I love you will become a litany for the ruined street. All will recite it, the loose tobacco seller, the flower thief, and those who own a loaf of bread, an empty bullet, and a donkey with a broken cart. So that's the opening, the poem. And it was such a heart-wrenching coincidence that that story about the napkin with the phrase, I love you so much, came out the second or third day after I translated it. And I have a task coming up. I've been invited to speak about the role of myth in Arabic poetry. And I cannot but think of this, how mythological that piece of napkin is.
Could you tell us about it? Because the readers don't know about it. Could you?
So the story that came out was that a young man murdered, a martyr, arrived in the hospital, one of the hospitals of Gaza, and the medical staff found in his pocket a napkin, a tissue, crumbled up because he probably had it in his pocket for a long time before he was killed. And it had the phrase, I love you so much, written in ink, in a black ink, and then traced over with red. And she signed it, the one who loves you, Habbush, which is the nickname for Hiba. So her name was Hiba, we know. And then she drew little hearts and arrows, and his name must have begun with the letter A, because it was A and H, loving each other. And again, the ordinary love between two young people who had time to sit down and write things on a piece of napkin that then becomes mythological when it ends up in his pocket after he was murdered by a genocidal, maniacal system. So I received that story right after I translated that poem, and thinking about the power of love, the ability to love against all odds. And it's something that Fadi Jouda speaks about a lot, love as resistance. So I just don't know what to say. I don't think we can, but stand in absolute awe in the face of this insistence on staying alive, as you said, Gaza's insistence on staying alive and dying, even death. Death in Gaza is something we have to learn from. It puts our lives, our small, petty little lives in perspective.
Now, I hear it all the time recently because I've been lucky to be talking with some people. And I had Yusuf Al-Jamal on a couple of weeks ago. And he had rearranged because of the Displaced in Gaza book that he did. And lost contact. And they said, he got on the Zoom and he said, I've been distracted. Exactly a week ago, my sister and her entire family were killed in Gaza. I said, Yusuf, we need to reschedule. And he said, no, that was a week ago. I have to do this. And he noted the figure of the phoenix in Palestine, you know, that the phoenix will rise again. And we talked a lot about the sense of obligation. And one of the stories in the Displaced in Gaza book is of a woman whose husband is killed on a rooftop trying to get food. And she recites the story over and over again of many trips to the rooftop, just trying to retrieve the body. And that sense of obligation and decency is transcendent. And this is what this poem signals as well, that I love you takes so many different shapes and forms, from acts to just objects that are endowed with meaning, from people whose lives are under constant threat or erased. And so I encourage the listeners to pick up the poem and to read Palestinian literature and poetry in general, but this poem in particular. When I heard the story of the napkin, it just brought tears to my eyes. You write also, a real poem defeats time. And this applies to old song in so many ways. And as I wrote to you before, I remind me of the last part of a recent interview I had with Fadi Jouda, which today's audience might look up and perhaps listen to. And I was asking Fadi about the Arabic language and genocide, and he said in part, quote, it's really a relief to live in Arabic because it is open to a tradition that is open to 1,500 years. They come from thousands of years before it. It's a living language, a living culture, and there's so many pockets and aspects in it in which you can find yourself free from this horrific mode of domination that convinces us that this is the way forward if you join, if you properly join. So could you talk a little bit about what he's getting at in terms of living in Arabic versus living in that belonging space that's carved for Palestinians, but constrained in this enormous fashion?
Yeah, for me, living in Arabic is being relieved of the burden of translating oneself and experience for an other who's uninterested, really. That's what I realized I've been doing all my life. This is what that exposed for me. It's something I knew, but never really knew as a graduate student and then as a professor in different institutions. Literally, in the immediate sense of translating, teaching Arabic in English in classes that are in translation is one form of it, but that the entirety of my existence in translation, and so much is lost, and there's a lot of bitter silences in my life that become more pronounced in horrific times like these. And then to exist in Arabic without the need to address or cater to outsider imperatives is such a liberated, minute moment in a day that could be full of horrors. It also relates to what I was speaking about, this insistence on studying the Arabic poetic tradition on its own terms, without imposed requirements or catering to interests that are non-literary to begin with, which is what we're dealing with in area studies. And it also relates to that class that's resistance literature from pre-Islamic Arabia to Palestine, where we say that a poem is always present. A good poem, there's no such thing as an old poem. In poetry, if a poem is really a poem, then it's always a poem about the present moment, as well as the moment 2,000 years ago. So we keep reading pre-Islamic poetry and engaging with it and even translating it because it speaks to things about our experience that we do not find other language for. And that's why we keep reading Mru'a and then the Abbasid poets. And the talk that you kindly attended was on that. The idea that let us now read the entirety of our tradition through the lens of Gaza because we can, because we're not imposing anything. Yeah. There are moments in this tradition that are perpetually present and they become much more urgent and immediate now in light of Gaza. But to be able to do that in Arabic without then the other side of the slide that is distorted, stuffy translation is liberation, is liberating. And it also speaks to something that, again, there and every podcast has to at some point mention Ghassan Kanafani. Another young, brilliant scholar, Rifa Abu, calls the Kanafani effect, which is a reminder to Palestinians that they have a responsibility towards themselves and other Palestinians first, before they go off on their campaigns to tell the world about Palestine. It's the internal Palestinian dialogue that we all stand to benefit from and that will liberate us as we witness it as non-Arabs on the outside. And Palestine owes us nothing, really. Because Palestinians have been doing this work for at least 80 years. They've developed a discourse about their Nakba that spills into all other fields of knowledge and life. And when a Palestinian speaks to themselves and to their others, that is triumph over the horrific, savage enemy that poses him or itself everywhere. It's also breaking out of the juxtaposition of the Palestinian and the Zionist all the time. And again, Judah calls it interiority. He's written and published about this recently as well. But it's also something that we strive for in the field of Arabic literary studies, not just in the United States, but back in the Arab world, because the imperatives, the colonial imperatives exist in institutions back home too. Yeah. How we need to study Arabic the way we study English and French. We need to divide it up into the same historical periods. We need to make sure that it measures up. When did modernism happen here? Did it happen at the same time and to the same success?
Exactly.
Resisting that is to say this is a tradition. This is a language, probably, I don't know how accurate this is, the only language that's been continuously alive, doesn't need to be translated into itself. Diction changes, use changes. But this Arabic is a language that has never died. So living in it is entirely possible. A full life is possible in Arabic. And translation becomes an afterthought.
That is so beautifully put. Thank you for it. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about? I'm so grateful for you being on the show, and you have so much to say, and I want to make sure that you have time to express anything else you'd like to get to. We've covered a lot, but not everything.
I'm very glad to be here again, David, and thank you for all the work you've been doing. I know how crucial it is for many of us, this space that you've created, but also your work with students. I had the pleasure of meeting some of your students, and I'm still very moved by how they speak of you. So thank you, and hopefully one day, after all this is distant, I know we'll have to account for it differently. But thank you is all I have to say.
Thank you, too. And please come back whenever you want. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. And thank you yourself for all your work, and especially these last few essays and this poem, which I'm just going to treasure.
I appreciate it.
Wonderful to see you. Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye.